What can turtles teach us about time, patience, and wisdom? What can we learn about the mysteries of consciousness by observing animals? How can we open our senses and embrace the interconnectedness of all life on Earth?
Author Cy Montgomery and illustrator Matt Patterson are naturalists, adventurers, and creative collaborators. Montgomery has published over 30 acclaimed nonfiction books for adults and children and received numerous honors, including Lifetime Achievement Awards from the Humane Society and the New England Booksellers Association. Patterson's illustrations have been featured in several books and magazines, such as Yankee Magazine and Fine Art Connoisseur. He is also a two-time recipient of the Roger Torrey Peterson Wild American Art Award. Most recently, Patterson provided illustrations for the book Freshwater Fish of the Northeast.
Their joint books are Of Time and Turtles and The Book of the Turtle. Montgomery's other books include The Soul of an Octopus and The Hawk's Way. Cy Montgomery and Matt Patterson, welcome to the Creative Process and One Planet podcast.
We are thrilled to be here with you.
Yes, thank you.
Well, it's great for us to speak with you as well. So we're speaking, you know, about your book Of Time and Turtles, Mending the World, Shell by Shattered Shell. I believe you've selected a passage to share with our listeners.
Yeah, we'd love to do that. This kind of sets the scene of how we started out on this whole voyage. Amid all the other homes on the suburban street, white, beige, gray, pale blue, light yellow, this two-story salt box stands out. It's a blazing neon green. Its flamboyance accentuated by an equally electrifying violet shed out back. The house bears a sign in front that reads, "Turtle Lover Parking Only. Violators better shut the shell up." Parked in the drive are a smart car and a black Scion. Both are mounted with strobe lights, like the ambulances they are. Emblazoned with the logo Turtle Rescue League and with stickers urging fellow motorists to stop for turtles in the road, help them get across, the cars serve as emergency vehicles for transporting injured turtles to the 1,000-square-foot turtle hospital that occupies the basement of the home. Observed by closed-circuit TV, one of several security measures taken because even sick or injured, turtles are so valuable on the black market that the patients here could be targets of abduction. Matt and I mount the steps to the wooden deck and knock on the door. Alexia Bell, Turtle Rescue League's president, lets us in. Once inside, Matt and I carefully step over a knee-high wooden barricade to enter the living room. We are soon met with the reason for the barricade.
Pizza Man, a 20-year-old, 12-pound red-footed tortoise with a knobby black and yellow shell, is headed towards us like a slow-motion missile. High stepping on columnar legs, his toenails tapping softly on the wooden floor, he holds his pale, yellow-bottomed shell, or plastron, tall as he paces determinedly across the room. He stops 2 inches from Cy's feet. He pointedly jerks his wizened-looking head to the right, holds it still for a second, jerks it back to the center, then jerks it to the left. He then swings his neck back to the center and stares up into Cy's face. Such a spirited reaction from a turtle might come as a surprise. While most people, like turtles, even many biologists for years dismissed the reptile's intellect as a little more sophisticated than that of a pet rock. Because turtles are famously slow and spend considerable amounts of time stock still, it's easy to get the impression they don't think or feel or know much or do much of anything at all. But clearly, Pizza Man was giving Cy a signal. Feels like a welcome.
You know, that's so interesting, these kind of preconceptions that we have. Obviously, you know these tortoises very well. You can read their personality. You can understand as much as we can understand their emotions. But I think the misconceptions that because they're slower, because they give minimal indications that we can understand, that might be an indicator of low intelligence. I always feel people who are subtle are smarter.
Yeah, and a turtle, reptile, they don't have the same facial muscles as we do or like our dogs do. And so you don't see the expression on their face the same way. But if you spend time with them, you get to know them and learn that each one is an individual, has its own personality.
And that's true, I think, of every animal, really. When people conclude, oh, that thing's so stupid, it's, you know, I can't tell what it is thinking or feeling, therefore it must not. I think the limitation is the human, because if you can't meet the animal halfway, you're the one who's lacking.
Indeed. And as you write about, it's just not the very visual one that we are used to.
Exactly. And we cut ourselves off from so much if we only look for our own reflection in the mirror. There's so many animals living these rich sensory lives in the real world, experiencing the real world that we will never touch. You know, animals that, as Henry Beston said, are living by voices we shall never hear. So much of animate creation can see polarized light, which is invisible to us, or hear tones, infrasonic or ultrasonic, that we will never hear. So much of that is going on all around us, and we're blind to it.
So you've both had projects beyond of time and turtles sigh. You scuba dived with sharks, cuddled with octopuses, slept next to, I believe, a mother hippo and her baby, been undressed by a wild octogenarian orangutan. What is your secret for making so many friends in the non-human animal world?
Well, don't let your study subjects eat you. No, really. Just pay attention and let your ignorance be your superpower. Cultivate that beginner's mind. Because every time you go into a relationship with any organism, including a fellow human, you're the student and they are the teacher.
Well, I love animals and spending time with animals. Dad was a biology teacher, so I grew up around animals and constantly learning about them. And I've just been fascinated my whole life. With especially turtles and fish, but there's so much we can learn and observe when you open your mind to new things.
Yeah, and you're, of course, an acclaimed wildlife artist, and you've helped rescue cold-stunned sea turtles, you know, raised baby-painted turtles for release into the wild. There's a story, of course, about the turtle fire chief who you live with provided physical therapy to. Just tell us about that story.
Fire Chief is a 42-pound common snapping turtle, and he has his name because he lived behind a fire station in a fire pond, and he's probably about 50-ish, or as Cy likes to say, he's 66, exactly her age.
Age appropriate, even though he's a reptile.
So when he got to this pond a long time ago, the road that he headed across wasn't as busy and it wasn't as big. Well, now it's a state highway, and every fall, he would go to a different pond across the street to roommates, like hibernation for them. And in 2018, he was crossing to his wintering pond, and he got hit. And it paralyzed his back legs and his tail. And the fireman saw him drag himself back to the pond he came from and roll down the hill with a cracked shell, bleeding. And they were worried. They loved him, but he's a snapping turtle. So they were afraid of him. So they called Turtle Rescue League. And these two skinny ladies came, one of them blind. And they found Fire Chief, took him back to their turtle hospital, and they patched him up. His shell healed. And when we met him, it had been 2 years since that injury. But his back legs still didn't work very well. And we started doing physical therapy with him. We would take him out and let him walk, get full gravity on his legs. And eventually, he started getting stronger. He still would flip over, and he couldn't right himself. And he wasn't really releasable for that reason. But we came up with a plan, didn't we?
We sure did. We actually went back to where he had been originally living. And it was like a pilgrimage to see his spot, the sweet little pond in the shape of a heart. But we realized with these cars whizzing back and forth, there's no way he could make it across. And so we found Matt and his wife, Erin, a new house. And the first thing they did before they moved in their furniture was dig a pond for Fire Chief. So he now rules his own pond.
You can now do wild turtle things, but he's safe. He's very neat too. He's not only the gentlest snapping turtle I've ever met, he's one of the gentlest animals I've ever met. You can scratch him in the face and feed him by hand, and he loves his neck and his shell scratched.
He's a real gentleman.
He has a very distinct and unique personality.
I wish people could see your faces as you're listening to each other and retell, you know, how he was rescued and how you rehabilitated him. That compassion really comes across, of course, in your writing, but just in this whole rapport that you have. Tell us a little bit about the Turtle Rescue League you mentioned there.
Well, when I first met Matt, we started doing turtley things together, and we're assisting this informal group headed up by a librarian and a retired school teacher who are protecting a nesting area not too far from where Matt and Erin used to live. And through that group, we learned about Turtle Rescue League. We went to a turtle summit that they held for folks who are interested in helping to heal turtles. Well, we came away absolutely gobsmacked. We saw turtles with cracked shells, missing limbs, turtles with brain injuries that caused them to roll over and not understand which end was up. And then they would show us 2 years later, that turtle healed and released back into the wild. And so we felt like we would love to be part of this miracle. We had no idea at that time what lay ahead, which was a pandemic. But I did know that I wanted this book about turtles to also be about time. It's one of two big questions in philosophy. One big mystery that I tackled in a previous book, Soul of an Octopus, was consciousness. The other problem in philosophy is time. And who better to lead me in this exploration than turtles, who live in some cases for centuries, rose with dinosaurs. Yet they survived the asteroid impact. They are the embodiment of patience and wisdom. But then the pandemic came and time stopped for most of the world, but not for us, because now we were on turtle time. And that added another dimension to our journey. The turtles had kept blessing us.
And when you're around them, I mean, you're living with them, right, in your backyard, do you find your heart rate slowing? What do you then notice when you live on turtle time?
We did slow down. It was very calming, especially in this world with all these distractions, social media and all these things going off, you know, ding, ding, ding. When we spent time with the turtles, everything around us would just kind of go away. Time would just go away. We called that slipping into turtle time.
Especially during the pandemic, not only was this killer disease on the rampage, but also horrendous political strife and environmental catastrophe. And as we were driving to Turtle Rescue League on election day, Matt and I would be listening to the radio, and then we would just spontaneously scream from the tension. But being with the turtles took that away. Living with any wild animal, particularly turtles, takes you away from the tick-tock, tick-tock time of your clocks and replaces that with cyclical seasonal time, what the Greeks called kairos, or sacred time, different from chronos, which is clock time. And the thing about clock time is, you know, you run out, you hit your deadline, or you come to the end of your life. But cyclical seasonal time connects you to all life and to eternity.
That's really interesting. I'm a philosophy student at the London School of Economics, and I was really interested where in your book you suggest that in the Western view, the progression of universal time in history is motivated by external change. And I was wondering, how is this view in tension with turtle time?
Well, with turtle time, it's constant renewal. Instead of coming up with something better and new and shiny, you know, evolution frequently is coming up with new ideas, but you always feel connected, not disconnected, to the past. When you listen to your instincts, that is the voice of your ancestors guiding you. And not just your human ancestors. It's your ancestors going all the way back to when everybody was just one cell. And being connected to your origin in that way is very different from the Western world in which you're off like an arrow and you've left all that behind.
Interesting. So you talk about being in conversation with our human and non-human ancestors, and like slowing the mind to a time before language. And so you discussed also in The Hawk's Way a different kind of love that you experienced. I think they're not as demonstrative, say, as the tortoises, or the love that you had in The Hummingbird's Gift. How could you express that love? How could you perceive that love?
Well, a hawk does not show you love that you would recognize. The love that you are allowed to give that hawk is not transactional. It's not, I love you if you love me. It is, I think, the purest kind of love when you love expecting nothing in return but the glory of being in the presence of that species. That's a very cleansing kind of love to experience.
And because you have different relationships with the salamander, with an octopus as well. How did you reach that point of communication and love?
Well, Sai took me to meet an octopus, a couple of them now, and they're different from us, but you totally can have a connection with that animal, even though it has eight arms and it's so different from you.
And this immutability of forms, the way that they can change themselves, do you find that renewing yourself instead of thinking yourself in a fixed way as someone who can adapt and change? If you could describe that experience.
Well, I think it's like that when you know and love a person who is unlike yourself. It broadens your life. I had a very good friend in college who was from Kuwait, and her culture was quite different from mine. But I just adored learning about her culture and learning about praying many times a day and facing the sacred spot. All of your friends are people of your same age, your same sex, same socioeconomic group, same language. That's not going to broaden you. Well, I feel that way when I cross species divides too, and just just start to learn, well, what's it like to be you? And wonderful as it is, having a person who you care about see you, having an animal recognize you and be interested in you, that acknowledges the animal in me. And that's the oldest, most sacred part of me, as far as I'm concerned.
That happened with us with some turtles that we were watching. And a turtle is really a focused animal. Whatever it's doing, it's focused completely on that. It's a real intense gaze. And we were looking at this critically endangered turtle. It might even be extinct in the wild. And it's this beautiful animal. And it was a little one. And then all of a sudden, he just looked up with his yellow eye, locked eyes with us. And that moment is in of time in turtles. That was a really special moment for us during the gaze.
And as you say, we can intuit that they have long memories. So they're seeing you, but they're memorizing you. There's not all these distractions. You know, I've seen the incredibly detailed and affectionate illustrations. What is your creative process?
Well, I spend a lot of time with the animals I paint. And whether it's in captivity or if it's in the wild, I'll observe them and take notes and sketches and take photos from different angles. And just, like Sai said, wanting to know what it's like to be them and learning about them, how they interact with each other or in their habitat. I use all that and combine it into an illustration.
Most of the illustrations that he's done that I've seen are of a particular individual who he knew personally. It's not just, I painted the turtle. It's like, that's Pete's man. You know,
in the Book of Turtles, a lot of those are turtles that you met as well. That
yes.
We met on some of our travels, and turtles I met in Madagascar or around here in New Hampshire. And of Time and Turtles is two colored illustrations, one of them the wood turtle, and that we have seen often at our nesting site where we volunteer to protect nests of five different species. And that turtle is a specific individual. He has a notch on him. He has a certain way he looks at you. And that's him in that illustration.
Yeah, they really do come alive. And as you talk about, you know, sketching or painting in the wild, like the freshwater fish or the difficulties of approaching, you know, a snake or a salamander.
Yeah. Well, with all animals, going into it with an open mind and wanting to learn as much as you can about them and why they're different and what they do and what makes them.
Yeah. He is great too at finding these animals in the wild. This is not in the book, but we had a wonderful time one day with some researchers from Zoo New England who took us out.
That was fun.
And it was really great. They had radio telemetry on some box turtles. And so they could hear beep, 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 and they could ostensibly find the turtle.
The closer the beep, the closer you are to a turtle, the one with the
radio
tag.
They knew that the turtle they were following was somewhere in a space probably the size of
like a coffee table.
But they could not find this animal. Matt found it. He just has turtle eyes. And we've been in kayaks together, and all of a sudden, bloop, his arm goes down, and bloop, he comes up with a turtle, like a magician pulling a rabbit out of a hat. And he's the same with snakes. He's the same with salamanders. He just has that eyes.
Well, if you look at that box turtle and you're holding it and not in its habitat, it has these bright orange speckles all over against black, and you would never think that would blend in. But when you see it in its natural habitat, it just totally disappears. And that pattern does camouflage it. And it did that day really well because it took forever for us to find them.
And another thing about Matt's art is that sometimes in a painting or a photograph, you look at the animal and it just looks terrified. Sometimes when painting insects, I've discovered that the model was actually dead or had been refrigerated, as happens with reptiles. Matt waits until they're calm, and he depicts them in a way they really are. I'll give you an example of bats. Most pictures of bats show the bat looking like a horrible vampire ready to swoop into your hair and give you rabies, which, by the way, they don't do. But Merlin Tuttle was the first to photograph calm bats that weren't baring their teeth. He took the time so that he could see what they looked like when they weren't petrified. And in these pictures, bats are really appealing little mammals. They're adorable. And when Matt paints a fish, a salamander, a snake, a turtle, he's painting it at its best when it's not frightened, when it's not refrigerated. You know, Audubon, when he painted all of his animals, every one of those were dead. He murdered every single animal. So, you know, he did a lot of good things in his life, but he was a slaveholder and he was a murderer. Matt didn't kill any of the animals he paints. So I say he's better than all.
No turtle harm.
Yeah, so there's also the story. You're painting or drawing a relationship.
I'm biased because I'm an illustrator, but in illustration, you can put all your experiences, like certain colors you saw or a posture or a look, and all that can be combined into that illustration. So you can have more meaning than you can with just a photograph.
Right, because a photograph must capture just that one moment.
And it doesn't always capture what you see or what you're experiencing.
Right, but in your painting, you can convey that.
You know, the sad truth is that a lot of young people don't get that opportunity to see what you've seen. And I think that the writing and the drawings are like an invitation to then go out. You know, what can they do? How can they better connect to see the magic and sense of wonder that you have from being close to nature? And so many young people can be quite fearful because everything is curated through a screen. So what would you say to the younger generation?
I would say to help turtles, we'll just focus on turtles. You don't have to be a researcher. Anyone can help. Like those ladies we were talking about with the nest protection, they're making a huge difference in conservation. So you can join conservation groups. Something is as easy and as little as if you see a turtle crossing the road, just help it in the direction it's going because they know where they're going. And if you turn them around, they'll just go right back in the road. But that makes a really big difference. Don't take turtles from the wild. If you find an injured one, you can call a rehabber. But all those are ways of helping turtles connect to turtles. And they're things that anyone can do. You don't need a degree to do that.
Yeah, and everyone knows turtles. Many people think, oh, turtles are in great shape. There's a ton of them in my pond. Well, turtles as a large group are over 300 species and 60% of them are perilously close to extinction. But turtles are common enough that most people have seen a turtle. You don't have to fly halfway around the world. We can all connect with wildlife right around our homes. And you can learn a lot just by sitting quietly and watching. My friend Lisa, she's actually a PhD biologist right now who studies tree kangaroos in Papua New Guinea. She had such bad asthma as a child, she couldn't play sports and she couldn't have a pet. But she loved animals, so she watched the ant crawl on the asphalt roof of her apartment when she was a kid. And today, she's hiking 10,000 feet up into the cloud forests of Papua New Guinea. But it all started with watching ants on asphalt. So there is wildness and wonder all around us, and we can all help preserve that wildness and wonder.
Another thing that I really enjoy is embracing the imperfections. You know, going back to Fire Chief, you described the Japanese art of kintsugi in the golden repair, which honors the broken edges of a repaired object by sealing them back together with precious gold or silver, which you describe beautifully in relation to healing the fire chief's shell. And I think that's a beautiful metaphor. We don't have to seek perfection, but we embrace the biodiversity of this planet and appreciating all the different life forms.
Well, it was a good thing for me, too. I'm 66 now. And if you get obsessed with perfection and you're going to live past like 24, you're not going to have a very good time of it. So it also helps me love all my wrinkles.
Well, in Fire Chief, all those scars and cracks in his shell doesn't make him broken. It makes him stronger, you know, it shows his history.
That's true. And actually, scar tissue is stronger than the tissue around it.
So he's a tough turtle, good looking turtle.
And his story's on his shell. You can read his story on his shell.
There's another funny story with a long-term relationship, Holdie and Bibi. And I think it was like a 115-year-old itch.
Yeah, that was a very good marriage for 115 years. And then one day she woke up and could not stand him. And all of my girlfriends are so relating to this. And the zookeepers at a reptile zoo in Austria desperately wanted their star attraction to stay together.
These are big Galapagos tortoises.
Yeah, these are like 500-pound tortoises. So they tried everything. They tried keeping them apart, thinking that absence would make the heart grow fonder. Then they tried feeding them delicious treats together like watermelon and that maybe they would bond over their romantic dinner out. They even tried reptile sex toys to see if that would help. Nothing helped and they had to separate them.
For probably another 115 years. It just shows how they all are, you know, the individuals with different personalities and thoughts and feelings because clearly, he did something that upset her.
Yeah, I don't know what he said. That shell makes you look fat. I don't know.
So, you know, on this question, the thoughts and feelings and the consciousness that I know you've addressed throughout your books, now people feel that perhaps AI will help us bridge that barrier of animal communication. And what are your explorations of that, your hopes for it?
Well, I would love it if AI could decode some animal languages that humans have not been able to do, like the whistles and clicks of whales and dolphins. Our human limitations have blinded us to so much of what animals are saying and telling us. More than anything, though, and I don't know if AI can do this, but we need something to talk our leaders into having some sense about preserving our world. Anything that AI can bring to ameliorate global climate change, to catch the poachers who are killing turtles and other wildlife, anything AI can teach us about how not to consume the entire world like some horrible fire. Let's leave some space for the animals. As a writer, AI also makes me nervous because I could be replaced by some program that just studies my 38 books and maybe can write the 39th one instead of me. But AI is with us, and I think the thing that needs doing in this world by humanity more than anything else is to stop the wholesale destruction of our planet. Let's use everything in our arsenal to stop that.
But when it comes to AI, and Sai is talking about replacing her as a writer or replacing me as an illustrator, it won't have that experience. And that's what you pour into all your stories. And I don't know how you can replicate that.
I hope not. I mean, what people say they value is authenticity, although we don't always behave that way. But humans are the ones that can impart authenticity to the creative experience. So I hope that continues.
Yeah, well, of course, the AI is disembodied. So as much as it replicates or sucks in all of our human content, it can't go out in the world. It can never do what you do. That embodied intelligence is hugely important. And could you talk a little bit about, you know, some of the teachers who inspired you on your path?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Mine were almost all animals, starting with my dog, Molly. She was a Scottish Terrier, and she was like the sister, the teacher, the angel I never had. And she was the one that showed me how to survive my childhood, actually. Emus in Australia, three wild emus, showed me the path that I needed to take to not work in an office and to work on my own. I had worked at a newspaper for 5 years, had an opportunity to go to Australia, joined Earthwatch, and had some field experience during a 2-week vacation in the Australian outback. And the principal investigator at the end of those 2 weeks says, I can see you're just on fire to do field research. I can't hire you and I can't give you any money, but if you ever wanted to research wild animals in Australia, you could stay at my camp and I'd give you food. So I quit my job and I moved to attend the outback. And I ended up following these three emus around, just seeing what they did all day. No one really had ever done that before. And they showed me, this is what I wanted do for the rest of my life. Christopher Hogwood, 750-pound pig with razor-sharp tusks. He showed me what family really was about because my human family disowned me when I married my husband. So that was the end of them. And I did not want to have children because of human overpopulation. So that was the end of that. But I had lots of children in my life and still do. And I learned how much fun they were from Christopher Hogwood, our pig, because they would come over and pet him and feed him and do pig spa. And until then, having grown up as an only child on an army base, I had no idea how much fun kids were. I didn't really like children when I was a child. So at every turn, there were animals helping me and guiding me. I also did have some great human teachers, one in particular, Mr. Clarkson, who was my journalism teacher at my second high school, Tastic. And he ended up moving to New Hampshire, and I got to see him later in life. I've had a mixed species family, and my teachers have had claws and scales and fur and tails.
And rhymes, too. Well, my father, like I mentioned before, was a biology teacher, but my parents, both of them, really encouraged me to live a life of animals and art. They let me do all sorts of things that most parents wouldn't let their kids do and have animals. You know, my mom put up with a lot of stuff. We were in Gatorland, a place where there's a lot of alligators, hence the name Gatorland. And we were on a boardwalk in the swamp, and I saw some turtles, and I was probably about fifth grade, and I was trying to hang off and reach down, try to pick one up, and my dad held my feet, and I was able to grab them, and he lowered me in. So yeah, my parents, my teachers, and like Sai, I've had a lot of animal teachers. My dogs bite growing up. I had a pigeon named Leroy, Leroy actually introduced us to the whole neighborhood because he used to go around and visit people and they would call and I'd have to go over and get them. And of course, Sai, who has taught me how to learn from good creatures.
Well, I think you already knew.
It's so refreshing because usually when I ask that question, it's human. Or sometimes books, sometimes writers say, oh, I learned so much from this author, though I never met them. I'm wondering what your reflections are on intuitive intelligence and this kind of a collective intelligence that non-human animals have more than us. You know, we're talking about consciousness being nested in the mind or nested in the body, but also it can extend beyond in a cloud and communicate at distances.
And I think that animals certainly don't have all these widgets demanding their attention like we do. Their spirits are just not as atomized as ours are. We have so many little things flickering at the edge of our consciousness. When we pay attention, we're not paying that deep attention. But animals are. And they have senses that we do not. They're aware of chemical cues that we completely miss. They see colors and kinds of light we can't perceive. But we all share a common ancestor. We share 90% of our genetic material with all placental mammals. So we really are all family. Seeing how animals do things, I think we have more access to that kind of consciousness than we allow ourselves to understand.
Once you start thinking like that, you realize that you're not separate from the natural world and animals and plants, but you're part of it. And being part of it is a really powerful thing. It makes you look at it differently. That's not right there, and I'm here. You're all one thing.
It makes a human feel less lonely. So many humans I know are just suffering terribly from loneliness, even though they're in a sea of other humans. Well, I never feel lonely. And I can be alone in a landscape with no other human anywhere. And I feel nested and safe and at home because there's all these other lives around us. And when you think of, as Mary Oliver said, our wild and precious life, I certainly cherish my one precious single life. But the life with a capital L all around me is so much more precious and so much more glorious. Being part of that just opens up my soul and frees me from everything.
My name is Virginia Moschetti, and as a philosophy student at the London School of Economics, I'm fascinated by the way Matt Patterson and Sy Montgomery are able to transcend clock time to access different temporalities and modes of embodiment. Clock time depicts human life as a series of bounded segments. Day by day, it parcels out our activities in linked blocks. One block for lunch, eight for work, two for the gym, and so on. Setting our timers and checking our calendars, we feel that time's momentum never exceeds us. Like the tidal excess of human experience can be dammed up behind the minute hand, leaving us to swim in the placid estuaries of metered routines. But this sense of control is an illusion, a byproduct of clock time's 16th century industrial origins when temporality first became spatial, something we could fill up with labor, exchange for profit, and use to circumscribe our own separateness from everything else. My life is my block of time. Its boundaries are fixed and non-transgressible like some imminent frontier. Strangely, these blocks and boundaries remind me of the letter I, that little structure responsible for preserving our identity against external and internal change. And graphically, I recalls a block of space-time, one made material and inhabitable, a dwelling place we choose to call our own. But just as much as it preserves, the I constrains. It forces our identity into a straitjacket in preparation for doing things and being things, ready to receive the verb that inevitably follows every iteration of I. And yet, as Matt and Sy indicate, human life is not reducible to the I, nor is identity something that can be separated and individualized. Instead, just by living and breathing, we are submerged in the cyclical temporality that encompasses all of life, the continuous ebb and flow that links us all together. In moments of silence, we intuit our basic connectedness with the world. For Virginia Woolf, this occurs when we find ourselves beyond the shrill of clocks that order us into individual eyes poised for action. For Matt and Sy, it happens when we sit quietly with nature, letting ourselves discard the self-importance of our eye to sink into the immensity of the world's temporal web. And by falling in time with the world, we start to see parallels, symmetries, connections, the junctures where our eye was once turtle or emu or gator, all the different modalities of eye we've had across time. Through their work, Matt and Sy show us that ultimately we are all inextricably connected. Their experiences with time and relationships with animals like Pizza Man make species divisions feel arbitrary, accidents we can attribute to the fault in our eyes. Looking at Matt's illustrations and reading Sy's books, difference no longer implies separateness or inferiority, but dips and diversions in the same temporal heritage we all share. And now, back to the interview.
And so what for you are the importance of the environmental humanities?
Boy, I mean, your mother, your concept of God, all of this I feel for our Earth, more than if Earth were a person. I grew up Christian, I grew up Methodist, and I still pray and read the Bible. If you believe that there is any creator, what better thing can you do with your life than honor the creation? And if you don't believe in that, but you understand the facts of evolution, which I also understand, again, what better use of a life than to honor the big life with a capital L? And what better way to enjoy it? There's so much that we can each do, and it is a joy for me I mean, I've been a vegetarian for 45 years. When I first gave up meat, I thought it would hurt my health. I now find out it's good for your health. So that was great. Choosing not to have children for overpopulation turned out to be exactly the right thing to do for the writing life and allowing me to meet the perfect mate. My husband is a writer as well, a better one than me. And we have wonderful children in our lives, but they're ones that we chose, not ones that just got randomly assigned to us genetically. So that was good. And, you know, not buying plastic. I don't have an electric car, but I have a hybrid car. I love driving past the gas stations, not giving them any of my money. Those bastards aren't getting 1 cent from me that I can avoid. So all of the ways in which you honor the earth with my writing, with my diet, with my family life, etc., every one of them just gives me a lot of joy. It's not a sacrifice. It's a joy.
You know, I don't even know what the question was now after that.
Is your art, Matt, bound up with, you know, obviously an appreciation for this Mother Earth, but with a spiritual path?
Well, I just want to inspire people to look and see what's out there and be in awe. This planet is precious and we need to protect it and not destroy it like we're doing right now. So my art is to shine a spotlight on certain species of animals and introduce them to those who maybe don't know them and don't get to see them in the wild.
As you think about the future and education, the importance of the arts, and of course, honoring our non-human animal family, what would you like young people to know, preserve, and remember?
I would like them to know, young people, you are not the leaders of tomorrow. You are the leaders of today. Children have more power than they realize. Even though you may not be able to vote, you have enormous influence in your family, and you can have enormous influence in your community. Look at Greta Thunberg, for example. Before she was old enough to vote, she deeply influenced the entire world. I have a little friend named, it's both of our friends, Heidi, who I met when she was 9 years old. And I came to her school, we were talking about octopus, and she came up to me and she said, "What can I do to help octopus?" And I said, you know, there's not a specific charity working to help octopus, but anything you do for the sea is going to help the octopus. And do you know that kid at age 9 went home, made a bunch of awesome crafts, sold them at a store, and donated thousands of dollars to a turtle hospital for sea turtles. This is 1 9-year-old and one action that she took. And who knows how many other people that she inspired. So no matter what your talent, no matter what your interest, no matter what your age, you can make a difference in this world for animals, for plants, and for people.
Now and in the future, young people are important. And I would want them to know, too, you're not separate from the natural world of the planet. You're part of it. And you don't have to go far places to see amazing things. You can live in a city and you can see ants crawling on the roof or pigeons, squirrels. There's stuff to see everywhere.
And stuff to discover.
And stuff to learn.
Most earthworms in America have not even been described. They are unknown to science. Lots of people have studied squirrels, but often you find the squirrels in your neighborhood are doing a totally different thing than squirrels in another neighborhood. They've found that birds have different dialects in different parts of the country.
Like an accent.
Yes, exactly. So no animal is too common that you can't find out something new. And kids who go in with beginner mind, because they only got born recently, they have the superpower of seeing everything for the first time. And let's pay attention to what they say. I had a new book called Secrets of the Octopus, and in it is an elementary school child who made a discovery about octopuses that is published in the scientific journal. And his name is Rohan Somnawira. And he was in the water and he noticed this fish was hanging around with this octopus. And every time he saw the octopus, he saw the fish. Well, this was an example of the fish following the octopus around to eat the stuff that the octopus scared out of cracks in the coral that the octopus wasn't himself eating. While fish and octopus had been seen working together before, that particular species of fish had never been observed doing this with that species of octopus. And this was a kid in elementary school, and you're reading the scientific journal, and his dad was the co-author, and his citation is, you know, CSIRO and University of blah, 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 and the other one is Smith Elementary School. It's so awesome.
I think it's a metaphor for your own relationship, this beautiful mutualism where you complement each other's work and you live just down the road.
We live on the same road, less than a mile.
It's a beautiful friendship, a beautiful collaboration, and it's just important to have a positive message in this negative world. So thank you, Cy Montgomery and Matt Patterson, for your compassionate storytelling and for all you do to help us understand animals and appreciate the mystery, wisdom, and wonder of time so we can live lives of greater purpose and meaning. We all live on one planet we call home. Thank you for adding your voice to One Planet Podcast and the creative process.
Thank you so much, Viv. We loved talking with you.
One Planet Podcast is supported by the Jan Michalski Foundation. This interview was conducted by Mia Funk and Virginia Moschetti, with the participation of collaborating universities and students. Associate interview producers on this episode were Sophie Garnier and Virginia Moschetti. One Planet Podcast is produced by Mia Funk. Additional production support by Katie Foster. Theme music is written and performed by Juan Sanchez. We hope you enjoyed this program. If you'd like to get involved in One Planet Podcast and be part of the climate change solution, just drop us a line at team@oneplanetpodcast.org. Thank you for listening.